Meanwhile, back in the year one, when you belonged to no one, you didn't stand a chance, son. If your pants were undone, 'cause you were bred for humanity and sold to society. One day you'll wake up in the present day, a million generations removed from expectations of being who you really want to be. Skating away, skating away, skating away on the thin ice of a new day. So as you push off from the shore, won't you turn your head once more and make your peace with everyone? But those who choose to stay will live just one more day to do the things they should have done. And as you cross the wilderness, suspending in your emptiness, you feel you have to pray. Looking for a sign that the universe of minds has written you into the passion play. Skating away, skating away, skating away on the thin ice of a new day.
And good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. My name's Paul Rowland. Be with you for the next hour until 9 o'clock when more great programming comes your way. We have a very special guest. Of course, all our guests are special. This one is with us all the way from England, the United Kingdom. As the climate protection movement or climate justice movement continues to build markedly so here in the Pacific Northwest, the rapidity of climate change is due to global warming from industrial carbon emissions, agriculture, and deforestation seems to be outpacing our best efforts. Many of us are only now becoming aware of the true dimensions of the changes that have been set in motion. Even though many scientists studying these dynamics have had a basic understanding of the likely scenarios, even they are alarmed at the pace of the change. One of those scientists is with us on the line, as I said, from the UK, Peter Wadhams, Professor of Ocean Physics and Head of the Polar Ocean Physics Group at the University of Cambridge, considered one of or the world's foremost Arctic expert. Good morning, Professor Wadhams.
Good afternoon for my end.
Yeah, there you go. So before we get into all this, you know, tomorrow there's a big vote. I hate to put you on the spot like this. Do you have any thoughts about the referendum tomorrow?
Well, only that I find it terrifying because Britain has been in the European Union for over 40 years now. We're completely embedded in it. It's part of our become part of our national view of the world. It involves working together with European nations, and the idea of giving all that up simply because of fear of immigrants, which I think is the main motive of the people who want to leave, it seems absurd. And yet there seems to be the possibility that there'll be a majority view in that direction. So I'm appalled at that.
Yeah, speaking of skating away on the thin ice of a new day, I thought in advance that song seems sort of appropriate. So combating climate change perspective, do you see how that plays into that at all?
Well, I suppose not. Probably from the point of view of combating climate change, all the nations of the world are meant to be working together. They certainly all signed the Paris Agreement, and each nation is supposed to come up with its own plans for how rapidly it's going to reduce its carbon emissions. So there wasn't a specific European Union input to the Paris Agreement. It was individual nations in Europe putting forward their own plans. So I suppose you can say in that sense, it doesn't matter whether we're in or out of Europe. But there's certainly a very strong environmental movement in Europe. And Green parties, for instance, are very strong in the European Parliament. So that would mean that Europe might be helping to guide Britain to make it a bit more fervent about climate change than it would otherwise be.
Well, let's bracket that discussion. The reason we're talking is because, most immediately I read the latest article by Robert Hunsaker, independent journalist who I've interviewed a couple times on this program as well, called The Epicenter of Obliteration, Arctic Ice, in which he talked extensively and quoted you from your recent appearance on the Tom Hartman program regarding an ice-free Arctic, a reality soon. That was just on June 9th, and I recommend that people check that out. It's on YouTube. And so he helped put me through to you. And I watched that program. And of course, I'm fairly, familiar with this stuff, but it's, it's interesting, as I noted, I think, in an email to you that, I don't want to, presume anything, but I assume that you haven't done a whole lot of, interviews in the mass media until more recently. I assume most of your speaking has been done in, lecture halls, at conferences, maybe the occasional press conference. But now you're seemingly thrust into the spotlight. I'd like to talk to you a little bit about that. But before we do, talk about, what's going on in the Arctic that some people aren't even aware of. What is happening with Arctic sea ice?
Well, it's a very dramatic time. The sea ice, ever since last fall, each month has been a record low for that particular month. So we're running, the ice extent in the Arctic is running well below the cycle that it should be following. And that means that when it really sinks to a summer minimum, which will happen in September, that minimum will be the lowest minimum we've ever had. And that's pretty clear from the trend. And the lowest minimum up to now was in 2012. It was just over 3 million square kilometres. So we might be down perhaps to 2 this year. So it's getting very close towards the time when we will actually have open water in the Arctic in September. That means perhaps open water as far as the North Pole. Now, that has enormous implications because the warm air that results, firstly, there's warm air because there's no ice there in the summer, so the warm air gets over to the Greenland ice sheet, and you find a lot of surface melt going on in the Greenland ice sheet in summer, much more than in the past, and that's accelerating global sea level rise. You find that the retreat of the sea ice is increasing decreasing the albedo of the Earth, replacing a lot of white stuff with a lot of dark stuff, and that's by decreasing the albedo, it means that more radiation is being absorbed, and that's also increasing accelerating the rate of warming of the planet.
So the white ice and snow reflects radiation back into the atmosphere, whereas the dark ocean absorbs it.
Yes, that's the difference, and it's a double difference, as you say, the snow involved as well, because there's a record low now in the area of snow that survives into the summer in the Northern Hemisphere. That's also got a huge negative anomaly that's as great as the sea ice anomaly. So you're reducing the area of sea ice in summer at the same time melting a similar area of snow. So that doubles the effect on the global albedo and therefore the effect on accelerating the rate of global warming.
So those, the whole idea of feedback loops, tipping points, triggers, all these things that people are kind of out there in the public discussion. We'll get into, but I don't know. Can you give us a just a really brief sort of physics and global physics climatology lesson on what are the importance of the polar ice regions in the climate and driving the global climate system? You just mentioned some points, but maybe get a little more in depth about it.
Yes, I mentioned a couple of points, and those are in fact the most important feedbacks. But there's another couple of feedbacks which are pretty terrifying. I mean, one is the fact that already the summer sea ice has retreated from the continental shelves of the Arctic. Now, the continental shelves make up about a third of the area of the Arctic Ocean, and they're very shallow. They're only 50 to 100 meters deep instead of 4,000. And underneath them, there is permafrost left over from the last ice age, which never melted since the ice age because there was always sea ice over the top, even in summer, and that kept the water temperature down to zero, even in summer, so that the water, there wasn't any melt going on. But now the sea ice has gone. We're getting very high water temperatures in summer around the edges of the Arctic Ocean, up to 10 degrees. And that warming gets to the seabed because it's shallow water, melts the offshore permafrost, and that releases huge quantities of methane. And this is already happening. It's been detected by lots of expeditions. And if it gets seriously worse, in other words, all the methane in those sediments starts to come out, that will really accelerate global warming because methane is a very powerful greenhouse gas. So there might be a really catastrophic effect happening very soon, which I've been warning about, a lot of other people have been warning about, but which is being ignored on the whole by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, possibly so as not to create too much public fear. But I think we need to be afraid of it and need to think about what we might be able to do about it. In general, the warming of the Arctic is, from the world climate point of view, is having an effect which tends to reduce the flow of heat between the tropical regions and the Arctic, because the Arctic's warming up faster than the rest of the planet. So the temperature difference between the Arctic and the tropical regions is getting less. So the ways in which heat is transported in the atmosphere and in the ocean tends to get slower. There's a lesser flow in the currents and the atmosphere. So that's one of the effects there, is that this tends to reduce the strength or the speed of the jet stream, which is the atmospheric boundary between polar air and warmer air at lower latitudes. And that's producing these big lobes in the jet stream, which are giving anomalous weather conditions, from giving some areas of the northern hemisphere extremely unusually warm conditions and others unusually cold conditions. It's a product of this change in the shape of the jet stream, which is itself a product of the warming of the Arctic. So we have some indirect effects there, which are quite serious because they have an impact on food production, as well as, of course, on our own environment, because this is happening in inhabited parts of the world.
Now, you mentioned the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and how there seemed to be some resistance. This is something I've heard about some of the researchers like yourself who have been talking about some of these more extreme possibilities that have perhaps not been listened to. How many, there's this idea that there's this out there, there's a, what they call it, I think a 97% consensus that climate change is human caused. And then, of course, I'm sure you're familiar with the on the blogosphere and the internet chat rooms and Facebook groups and stuff, there's this war, between the AGW, anthropogenic global warming believers, and the the non-believers or the denialists, which is one of the many tragedies of our times, that that's taking up so much of our precious attention and deviating us from what we need to be really talking about. But, you know, is there a growing awareness amongst the people, you know, the studying these climate change dynamics that about what's really happening? Are people just sort of getting up to speed like some of the rest of us are?
Well, it's a difficult question. I think that this 97% versus 3% is certainly the case. Nearly everybody who's studied the climate or any part of the climate is convinced that what it's man that is causing the warming, and of course simple physics says that it is, because you can high school physics tells you if you increase levels of carbon dioxide and certain other gases in the atmosphere, they absorb more of the outgoing radiation from the Earth's surface, and if you absorb some of the outgoing radiation while the incoming radiation stays the same, which is the solar radiation, then to balance that on a ball floating in space, the only way you can do it is by raising its temperature so it emits more. And that's really high school physics, and you can't to say that that's not happening is like saying the Earth is flat or gravity doesn't exist or something. It's very, very basic that we inevitably will increase the temperature of the planet by adding CO2, and we are adding CO2. So it's not really possible to deny that man is causing all or a large part of the warming that's going on without saying, well, I'm denying physics. I don't believe in physics. So that's not possible. The more subtle difficulty that's happening is amongst the climate scientists who obviously believe that our input is changing the climate. There's a kind of resistance to accepting that it's happening fast. There's a kind of complacency amongst climate scientists, amongst quite a few climate scientists, especially modelers, towards how fast these changes are going on. And in fact, there's, in the case of Arctic sea ice, there's a complete detachment between the people who actually measure it and observe it and measure how its area is going down and its volume's going down, and on that basis predict that it will disappear very quickly in the summer. And then there's a group of computer modelers who don't actually deal with the data, but have models, and the models predict that it will stay around for a long time. So that under those circumstances, there was a very famous scientist, Richard Feynman, who said, if you have a model, no matter how beautiful it is, and it doesn't match the data, then it's wrong. But there is a tendency amongst some scientists to prefer the model to the data, that if the model disagrees with the data, you ignore the data. So that tends to mean that the modeling community has been adopting a much more complacent view of how fast these changes are happening than the observational community, who are actually going out there and measuring what's going on. So that's an unfortunate thing as well, in that climate change scientists, or climate scientists themselves, have internal disagreements about how fast climate change is happening, and therefore how urgent it is that we should be taking action.
And I take it might be a safe assumption then to say that the, you know, policymakers and all those who, you know, may have to try to implement policy or make changes in their business practices or whatever, might prefer to look at the modeler's approach rather than the hard observation data.
Yes, I think that's the case. They intrinsically prefer the modeler's approach because it tends to produce slower effects. And also the modeling community, well, they come from all over. They include university types, but a lot of the big models are run by national government bodies. I mean, in Britain, for instance, the Meteorological Office. And so therefore, again, the policymakers have a tendency to believe the modelers because the modelers use big, expensive computers and work for government bodies.
Mm-hmm. And so this is a good time to talk a little bit about yourself. I assume you're not just sort of, because you yourself come from the actual hard research, getting out in the field. You're prejudiced against the others because of that. I think you've explained well why that position something that's a more attuned to the actual reality of what's going on. But talk a little bit about your own experience. You've had decades of experience actually doing expeditions up into the Arctic. Tell us a little bit about why you feel so confident about your own approach.
Well, I've been working in the Arctic for more than 40 years now, 46 years, and I've done about 50 expeditions. And of course, first of all, you see over such a long period, you see big changes going on. Like when I first went to the Arctic, most of the ice in the Arctic was multi-year ice, which is very, very thick, rugged ice of a traditional kind, the white hell of the Arctic. You couldn't get through it with an icebreaker even. It was really tough stuff. And now that's nearly all gone. The ice is mostly first-year ice, which forms in the winter, melts in the summer, and it's very thin. So the whole landscape of the Arctic Ocean is completely changed. I've been measuring ice thickness since those early days by working from submarines in the Arctic. So I've done six voyages to the Arctic in submarines spread out over a long period. And each time the average ice thickness, which you measure with upward-looking sonar, has gone down. And the same has been done by American scientists working from US submarines. And we came up with a figure of at least a 50% reduction in average ice thickness over the last 30 years. So with that amount of reduction in thickness combined with a reduction in area, which is given by satellite data, it means that we're now down to about a quarter of the volume of ice in the Arctic in the summer present now as there was 30 years ago. That's a huge change. I don't think there's any other parameter or any other quantity on the planet which has changed that much in 30 years. It's a drastic decrease, and that decrease is all set really to go a bit further in the next year or two and bring us to a completely open Arctic during the summer, not in the winter, of course.
So that's really remarkable that you've seen this playing out in real time over almost like your own time lapse view on this. At what point did you see the possible scenarios that are playing out right now? At what point do you think you really realized the extreme urgency of what was happening?
Well, in 1990, I made really the first measurements that showed by repeating the same voyage, the same grid of track over the Arctic Ocean in a submarine, over an 11-year gap, I found a 15% decreased thickness, which was a very substantial decrease then. It was just the starter, though. It's now more than 50%. And that was when I published a paper then, which was really, I think, the first paper on thinning. And that stimulated a lot of people to look carefully at their data and collect new data. And that's then brought this to closer attention of the scientific community. So I suppose it was probably about 10 years ago or so that it was clear that from the trend of thickness and area that had been now then measured from satellites and from submarines that trend would take you to zero for summer within about a decade. And there were modellers who were agreeing with that, and these were modellers who were very careful to include all the possible physical processes that occur in sea ice, as opposed to models which are where the ice is just part of the overall global climate and not considered as an entity. And so the modellers who took very good care to include the small-scale processes were coming up with similar dates. And one of those, for instance, was Maslowski at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, who was one of the first to give a model prediction that agreed with these predictions based on observation, that it would be round about 2016 or so that we would expect to see the summer Arctic ice pretty much go.
So I guess as the old adage goes, garbage in, garbage out. If you don't have all the data present, your model doesn't reflect reality.
Yes, that's the problem. And that's why, in a sense, a modeler should also be going to the Arctic and making observations so that he can make sure that all the important processes that occur are included in the model.
So before we open up to callers, and the number will be 503-231-8187 to call in for this unique opportunity to engage with a foremost expert on what is happening right now in the Arctic, which is a major driver of the climatic processes globally. And we're, of course, leaving out of the picture the Antarctic. We probably won't even have time to talk about that. I'm sure you must know some things about that as well. But this is extremely terrifying picture, really. I hate to put in such stark terms, almost apocalyptic. And again, as you said, there's probably all sorts of resistances, on all sorts of different levels, on a personal psychic level, institutional level, political level, to coming to grips with what you're talking about. But, and then there's those who say Paul Beckwith, who I interviewed on this program, has a really excellent new video, which I recommend, exploring this whole concept of being too late. What does too late mean? I would really recommend that to people. I'm going to link to that on this the program page for this. But so you've laid out some of these basic dynamics of what's happening, and the implications are major convulsions of the global climate from what's happening right now with massive wildfires, the major heat wave that's going on right now that's spreading out from the southwest of the United States, massive unprecedented heat wave that hit India just a few weeks ago, and on and on and on, the continuing drought in California. So you're being someone who's so intimately familiar with this, I would need to take what you're saying very seriously. And you are talking about also responses. You're called upon to, actually pronounce on things that aren't necessarily in your specific realm of expertise, which is, ocean physics and studying all these dynamics. And so you have to talk, you feel called upon about public policy and lots of other things. And so one of the things you're talking about is our geoengineering and carbon drawdown, and I'll ask you to explain those things. And I'll just preface by saying, as an activist myself, I've been very resistant to this idea of geoengineering. When I first heard about it, I don't know, 10 years or so ago, it just seemed like another our obsession with technical fixes and our inability to actually deal on a on a human level of what we're actually doing. But what you're putting out is actually the thing. The pace of change is so fast that even our best efforts at changing policy and stopping fossil fuel infrastructure projects, which we've had a lot of success with here in the Pacific Northwest, are possibly not sufficient. Which is not to say that you're you're saying we should stop those efforts, I assume.
Yes, well, I agree. Those efforts are very important, but in a sense, the efforts are based on the idea that we should be leaving a lot of coal and oil in the ground and not mining or drilling to get all the rest of the hydrocarbons that exist, and that's the important point, really, that if we burn all the rest of the hydrocarbons that there are, we will have a warming that is going way off the map. And the trouble is, we are sort of set to burn all the hydrocarbons that there are, because although you can stop particular projects, and that's very important to do when those projects are clearly bad for the environment, like tar sands, then you can stop those. But the ultimate thing is to achieve a global, not just a reduction, but a global abolition almost of fossil fuel burning. And that's a massive thing to do. And the more you think about how can that be achieved in a world which is based on the aircraft and the motor car and the ship, and how do you manage to make such a world not dependent on all of these things, where our cities are dependent on the layout of our cities. Wherever you look in the world, we are dependent on fossil fuels. So whatever politicians say, or even climate activists say about reducing carbon emissions, my fear is that we simply can't, even with a lot of goodwill. The drastic nature of what needs to be done means that it won't be done, because people don't perceive it as an immediate threat. I mean, if you're attacked, like in the Second World War, you devote everything to fighting off your attacker. But if the attack is on the entire planet, but it's a slow attack, which is climate change, you tend not to do anything. You put it off. And that's, I fear, what's happening, and which is why, like you, I was always opposed to geoengineering, because of the habit feeling that having messed up the Earth through our technology, if we try and fix it through technology, we'll probably mess it up even more. But the trouble is, I fear that we have to try and fix it through technology, because we're simply not going to reduce our carbon emissions fast enough to avoid a sort of catastrophic climate change. So we've got to find a way to either mask or reduce the rate of warming, which is what geoengineering do, or in the long run actually take carbon out of the atmosphere, which is the only long-term solution.
Well, we've kind of introduced the subject. I think we have time to get deeper into specifics of geoengineering and what you mean by carbon drawdown, drawing carbon out of the atmosphere. But we have a couple callers who've been waiting. So let's go to our first caller. Dave, you're on the line. You're on the air.
Hi. This is a great, great show. Really important information. I actually work on the kind of the political end of trying to deal with climate change. I'm totally in favor of a World War II level of mobilization of workforce and resources to deal with it. But what's happening right now is there's going to be a summit on just transition to shift from the carbon economy to a clean energy economy. And that's going to affect a lot of communities and workers, and they need to be taken care of. I was really happy to hear the Diablo Canyon Agreement really does take care of the workers there. and you know, and works to make them safe as they shut that plant down and deal with the waste, and also make sure they have jobs and livings, and that the community continues to be a healthy community.
That could be a model for a much wider transition. Should we have the ability to go that way? So talk where and when is this summit on just transition?
Okay, it's going to be on the 7th, which is a Thursday, 7th of July, and there's going to be a big public meeting in the evening of that the 7th of July at the Unitarian Church.
Oh, so that's here in Portland. Okay.
Yeah. It's a regional conference. People are coming from Vancouver, B.C., and the Bay Area, and every place in between, to truly try to work out. The daytime session is limited to a fairly few people, and they're going to try to work out a real plan for changing things and in a way that's just for the communities and workers affected.
Listen, Dave,
the evening program's going to have the anchor for all this is this guy Joe Uline, he comes from the Labor Network for Sustainability.
Okay. Well, listen, Dave, I just want to maximize our time here with Professor Wadhams. So do you have a? I'll be talking about this on a future show, I'm sure. So and I'll find out information and try to link to that. And so I'm sure we'll be talking about that on various shows here on KBOO. Do you have a specific question for Professor Wadhams?
I think he's answering the questions.
Okay.
It's just so urgent.
All right. Well, thank you so much for calling.
Yeah, thanks.
I think we have another call. Do you want to respond to any of that?
Just a comment. I mean, again, it's a bit outside my field, but he's right very much in this question of you can't just say we're going to give up fossil fuel use, which is, we do have to say that, but we have to keep the world going, and the world is industry based. It's a consumer of energy, and if we're going to switch to renewable energy, for instance, we've got to have the renewable energy there ready to go before we can shut down the fossil energy, plus of course a lot of people's livelihoods as well. So we can't just abolish fossil fuels because the world has to keep going. We have to be able to bring in the renewable energies fast enough to be able to replace the fossil fuels.
Okay, we have another caller. Patrick, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Paul. This is Patrick Mazza.
Oh, hey, Patrick. How's it going?
So we're, Paul and I are old friends, Dr. Wadhams. We've been in activist causes on and off for many years. And I've been working climate for a long time. And it does seem like, as the previous caller mentioned, that the only thing that really makes sense now is a World War II scale mobilization. That, you know, where we really begin to reduce carbon, you know, somewhere in the range that Jim Hansen talks about in the science he's done for the Our Children's Trust lawsuits, which, I mean, it's imposing. It's like now probably, 8 to 10% a year. And I think what we need, we need the scientists to really step up and say, this is what we need. I know I've been connecting with a group called the Climate Mobilization, which is calling for a World War II scale mobilization. And one of their endorsers is Michael Mann. So, it's starting to come up, but, I have to unfortunately agree. I think we probably are so late in the game that we will need some form of solar masking. Anyway, I don't know if that's more of a comment than a question, but do you see, at least some scientists just standing up and saying, we've got to go for this and go for this big time and right now and really specifying it?
Yes, I'm beginning to see it, and it's still not strong enough. On your comment, I think there are a few hopeful signs about being able to rapidly reduce carbon emissions, just again through the advance of technology. For instance, solar energy has decreased in cost so rapidly that it went from being a sort of joke that solar power is only good for recharging your solar watch or something, but suddenly it can become as cheap as fossil fuel, and even as flexible that to use it as a baseline source of power, even though it gets dark at night. There's now lots of new advances in battery technology, and yes. I'd like to mention a great one that's just come about at Harvard. Professor Aziz has developed a flow conversion system, which is a kind of like a giant fuel cell, which gives you huge amounts of energy storage. So you can use that in conjunction with solar power to really make solar power into a baseline power system. But I still think it won't work on fast enough. I mean, I think that system will work, but man won't be able to change himself fast enough. So we do need this Manhattan Project sort of thing, and it needs, for that, it needs enormous commitment of energy, of money and effort, and it needs the scientists and engineers who are working on it to really be fixated on what the target is, and the target, I think, has to be getting carbon out of the atmosphere, because if we target the geoengineering techniques of solar radiation management and so on, all of those techniques are fine, and they will be able to stop, temporarily at least, global warming, so long as you keep applying them. But it won't change things like, if you don't change the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, it won't be able to solve the problem of acidification of the oceans, which could destroy the whole ocean ecosystem. So you've got the fixation that you have in this Manhattan Project, instead of being on building an atomic bomb, should be on developing a system that takes carbon out of the atmosphere directly. And there are systems that seem to work. There's an idea about a kind of artificial trees that you pump air through and have chemicals that will absorb CO2. You've got various bright ideas, but without much money behind them. But in a way, that should be where most of the money for research should go. We should, instead of super colliders, we should be putting all our money into developing methods of taking carbon directly out of the atmosphere at an acceptable cost.
Well, listen, thank you for calling, Patrick. We get okay. Before we go to next caller, I just want to remind people that this is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm your host, Paul Roland, and I'm speaking with Peter Wadhams, professor of ocean physics and head of the Polar Ocean Physics Group at the University of Cambridge in the UK, I'm speaking with him there at his office. He's a foremost expert on the Arctic, as you've heard, and we're talking about the dramatic situation of the dramatic situation of the loss of Arctic sea ice, which has magnifying, reverberating feedbacks, which we've gotten into to some extent, but we may or may not have time to go further with that. Coming up next on KBOO at 9 on Waterworld, Kristen Yount hosts an update on the EPA Superfund site at the Willamette Harbor with Rose Longoria of the Yakima Nation's Fisheries and Dr. Peter Defer of the consulting group Environmental Stewardship Concepts. And as always, we thank all of you KBOO members who support this station and this programming. If you're not currently a member, you can easily become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. So we have another caller waiting. Let's go to Cheryl. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning, Professor Wadham and Paul. I'm delighted to be able to speak with you. This is a question I have had my entire life, and I would like an answer for this. Is the extraction of oil from the Earth's mantle a cause of global warming?
Well, I think the burning of the oil is, but you mean the actual geological impact of the extraction process rather than just the
Yes,
burning?
I've likened it to a ball bearing situation in which we all are aware that the core of the Earth is basically a fireball of gases and iron and so on, ionized. And I've thought perhaps because there has been so much oil, it has acted as a lubricant, and that the more we take out, the closer that hot core is to the mantle, which could be a global warming cause. And I have, it does perhaps seem far-fetched, but I've wondered about that, and I thought perhaps you would have that answer. And may I, before you, I just finish with you. Wouldn't the ideal be if we could have a financially free remedy to this because of the import of what it is and what it's doing to future populations? So that's the other comment. But the question, is there such a thing?
Thank you.
I don't think the extraction can have that sort of impact that you mentioned, because the distances are too great. The oil is obtained from very close to the surface within the Earth's crust, and then below the crust is the mantle, which is several hundred miles thick, and then you have the core. So extracting oil from the Earth's crust isn't going to do anything as far as affecting the Earth's core. I mean, it may have some effect sometimes in triggering earthquakes and so on, and that's what people are finding with fracking, for instance. But so it can have local effects, but that's because that's only close to the surface, so I don't think it would have effects deeper down.
So,
then as far as the question of what was your second question?
Oh, finance free. Well, let me redirect that question to something I wanted to get at, which is, I think, directly related, since we only have about 10 minutes left. Is everything that you're talking about, this, you know, Manhattan Project or World War II style mobilization that people are talking about, it's all dependent upon the premise that there actually can be some form of redirection of resources and coordination of those resources in a world system that is dominated by private corporate control of resources and military control of resources and the continued deployment of the resources towards warfare and military buildups that are going always in the exact opposite direction. There's this terrible paradox that we're caught up in. And I personally am very skeptical of seeing that issue resolved.
Well, yes. I mean, there's pluses and minuses, I suppose. I think there's something like 55% of all scientific research is military research. So if scientists could be diverted from doing research on military matters to doing research on something that could help save the world, then you can redeploy more than half the world's scientists. But on the other hand, it was the Pentagon that was one of the earliest organizations to recognize that Arctic change is very rapid and serious, and that's because they have the responsibility, presumably, of defending the open ocean that's being created. So they've been on this case of retreat of sea ice and climate change ahead of many other organizations. There's an opposite point of view. And finance, I suppose the point here is that there are these integrated assessment models, economic models, which take climate change into account and then look at what the global cost of all that is. And I was involved with one of these a couple of years ago when we looked at what would happen if there was a big methane outbreak from the Arctic. And using the model that was used for the Stern report on climate change, the model came up with a cost of $60 trillion over a century for the impact of all that extra methane on global climate. Now, if you run that sort of economic model, come up with these dizzying costs of a climate change effect, it does help to focus politicians and people's attention on the cost of doing and implementing some massive intervention to take carbon out of the atmosphere could still be far, far less, orders of magnitude less, than the damage that not doing that is going to do to the planet. So financially, if global economic modelling can show that, in fact, we save money by making a Manhattan project type initiative. In the long run, it's going to save us a lot, even though it's costing a lot.
So we do have at least one more caller. Before we get to them, I just want, you know, since we only have a few minutes left with you, I want to make sure you're able to get out all the major points that you want to in this hour here. Is there anything that you want to follow up on or a new point that you want to make at this point?
Well, no, I think I think I've said most of what I would like to say. And of course, I'm very, very impressed by a lot of what's going on in the U.S. And it's because and people like James Hansen were pioneers in drawing attention to the impact of climate change and the need to do something about it. And a lot of the things I find going on in the States are very, very heartening. Compared to the sort of foot dragging that goes on in Britain.
Okay, well, let's go to our next caller then. I think Mark is on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to touch on one part of the subject that you didn't touch on, which is the maritime advantages and potential that the opening of the actual Northwest Passage creates, at least in the summertime, and that are any of the big shippers taking advantage of that yet or what?
Yes, in fact, one other thing I wanted to mention is I've got a book coming out very shortly, which includes a discussion of this, called A Farewell to Ice, which is coming out in September with Penguin. And I talk about what various impacts of sea ice retreat are going to be. And one of them is, of course, shipping. The retreat of sea ice in summer is allowing the northern sea route north of Russia to be used as a shipping route, and the Northwest Passage is coming into use, although there's more ice around in the Northwest Passage. But the ultimate goal would be a transarctic shipping route across the North Pole, because that's the greatest shortening of the distance between Far East and the West Coast of the U.S. and Europe. And those are coming along fast, and certainly there will be a saving both in cost for shipping and a saving in emissions, because the ships will be traveling lower distances. But the saving, of course, is a lot less than the cost of the various other nasty things. But already it's happening. There's shipping now regularly using the Northern Sea Route during the summer months. And there's a cruise ship going through the Northwest Passage this summer. So it's developing quite fast.
So, of course, they'll be burning more fossil fuels because they have more area to exploit, and they'll be drilling for more fossil fuels under the sea because there's more areas open, which will just accelerate. That's another feedback loop that we haven't talked about yet. But we've got Anita with a quick question. Let's go to that.
Hello.
Hello.
I wondered, Professor, if you have any inspirations on how to create a critical mass of human awareness, because I think most great movements start with a very basic critical mass of people who get it. And get it in a way that they can't do anything but work on it, such as you do with the work you're doing. And I think there's at least a sliver of hope there. If we can get to that critical mass, then we can get the World War II type mobilization. And I'd like your thoughts on that, and I'll take them off the air. Thank you so much.
Well, I simply don't know is the answer. To kick start something that needs to be that big and needs to be that big urgently, it only worked in the Manhattan Project because there was a direct threat that they thought people thought Hitler was getting the atomic bomb. So there was a direct threat to our very existence. And there is now, but it's not so apparent, and therefore people are less keen to make the massive effort that's required. So I simply don't know how to achieve that. In a sense, it has to come from the top, and you'd need a president who takes that on board as a very, very urgent thing. And we haven't had one who's given more than sort of lip service to it. So I really don't know. That's the thing that makes me most despondent, I think, is seeing that we have to go for CO2 removal in the long run if we're going to survive as a society, and that needs intense research and that application, yet there's no sign that anybody's going to do it.
Well, I think you're breaking the ice, to use a terrible metaphor here, and programs like this, and you're appearing on Tom Hartman, and the grassroots movement forcing change, at least on the municipal level, and sometimes the state level. There is no magic formula, but as they say, direct action sometimes gets the goods, and that's what we advocate here on Wednesday Talk Radio. But so we got to run here. We're just about got about a minute left. If you have any last thoughts, I'm glad you thought of mentioning your book, which I was going to. A farewell.
I almost forgot it. Yes, a farewell to ice. I stole the title from Hemingway, but it's about all of these climate impacts and feedbacks to the global climate that occur as the sea ice retreats. It's not the sea ice disappearance is not just a local factor. It helps drive a lot of other very serious things.
And again, the interview you did with Tom Hartman is available on YouTube. That's another excellent place. I just want to give a shout out to Robert Hunsicker, who's been doing some of the best and in-depth reporting on this issue, as well as Fukushima, for a couple years now, at least. His latest piece is The Epicenter of Obliteration, Arctic Ice. And again, Paul Beckwith has this wonderful this discussion of what it means to be too late. Whether it is, whether it is not, that's on YouTube. He's got a whole series of YouTube. That's Paul Beckwith. I'll have him on again. So I just want to thank you so much. We're out of time, and hopefully we'll be able to have you back on before too many months go by. Thank you, Professor Wadhams.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Okay. And that was, again, Professor Peter Wadhams, Professor of Ocean Physics and Head of the Polar Ocean Physics Group at the University of Cambridge, UK. This is Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio. Thank you so much. Stay tuned.
For humanity and souls to society. One day you'll wake up in the present day. A million generations removed from expectations of being who you really want to be.